Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In film and television, it's easy to like the villain. We hate drug dealers, but we'll watch Breaking Bad's Walter White, Weed's Nancy Botwin, or The Wire's Omar Little all day long. No one wants to be taken by a con artist, but movies from The Sting to Catch Me If You Can have glorified the grifter. But in real life, we tend to hate the villain, except when we don't. D.B. Cooper was a skyjacker who put hundreds of people at risk solely for money, but today, he's a folk hero. My guest today reflects on the nature of villainy and asks, who are the bad guys? Why do we embrace some and loathe others? Chuck Klosterman is a writer and essayist, author of 5 previous nonfiction books, including Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs, and Eating the Dinosaur. He's written for GQ, Esquire, Spin Magazine, The Washington Post, and currently writes the Ethicist column for the New York Times Magazine and writes on sports for ESPN. His most recent book, I Wear the Black Hat, is out in a new softcover edition from Scribner's. He joins us today via Skype on Studio Tulsa. Chuck Klosterman is my guest today. Chuck Klosterman, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, it's great to be here.
This book, I Wear the Black Hat, which came out last year, you added some more essays for the softcover edition. And it's really interesting. You sort of focus on the whole aspect of villainy, the idea of being a villain, of who is a villain and who's not a villain, and how the same behaviors can make you a villain or not a villain. What interests you in this whole concept?
Well, you know, the real answer to that question might be just the typical maturation process of getting older. There's a reference really early in the book. It's only a couple paragraphs where I mentioned kind of talking about the idea for this book. It's in the preface with my editor, and his son, who was at 4, I think, at the time, had just seen Star Wars for the first time. And it kind of blew his mind, as that movie might do to any 4-year-old. But I was saying how I have always had this theory that, you know, when you're a little guy and you see the Star Wars films, the character you love is Luke Skywalker, who is totally good, totally heroic, someone you can aspire to. If you're on the playground playing Star Wars, that's who you want to be. And then you move into high school, and suddenly then Han Solo becomes the character you find most intriguing, because he is still fundamentally good, but sort of has the trappings of being bad, or at least anti-authority, yes, or rebellious, or not sort of a cookie-cutter character, but in many ways mirrors how teenagers want to feel. They want to be good people, but they want people to perceive them as dangerous. Then you move into an adulthood, you know, years pass. Maybe you see the movie again for the first time in 15 years, and it's a different film. And at that point, the character that seems most important, and maybe the only character that seems essential, is Darth Vader. You read the movie differently, and you start realizing that the way people live in life, nonfiction or in fiction, that there are factors that make people into who they are. They're not just sort of born into, you know, a diabolical frame or a purely good frame. They kind of are made into this. And I think that really, to me, sort of reflects a lot of my thinking in this book as a whole, this idea of getting a little bit older and thinking about characters, both real and imagined, and sort of trying to deduce why we as a mediated culture have decided that they are good or bad.
Yeah, we don't want to think about the motives of a villain or anyone we term a villain. We don't want to think of the mediating behaviors in between that, do we?
Well, I mean, that's one of the central questions I kind of think about is, what is more troubling to people? The idea of a villain with a specific motive for his actions, or the idea of a villain with no motive? When you're younger, you tend to gravitate toward the idea of that second category, the idea that someone is just sort of acting capriciously, almost like a sociopath or whatever, that they're doing bad things and there's no reason for it. You know, in the old Dudley Do-Right cartoons, Snidely Whiplash was like, he was this evil person constantly tying women to railroad tracks for no explanation. You know, he was just who he was. He was the kind of guy who tied people to railroad tracks. But yet, what's really terrifying is when we find someone's villainous behavior does have a motive, and even though the behavior is problematic, the motive we relate to, and it starts to make the average person sort of look at themselves differently and, like, wonder, what am I capable of? If my life turned out differently, if I was in a position I could not control, how might I behave?
Right. And that's the subtext that's a part of all of these collections of essays. And I think your editor nailed it on the head. It says, are you trying to convince yourself you're not a villain?
Well, you know, his argument was that I think I'm a villain, even though, or no, I feel like a villain. Even though intellectually I know that doesn't really make sense, but I feel that, you know. Whenever there's a movie, say a James Bond movie or whatever, and you see the actors interviewed, the person who plays the bad guy inevitably will be asked, you know, why did you just, you know, why did you want to become this villain, you know? And they will always say, well, you know, the villain was more interesting. I was just more interested by this person, you know. But I think with the word they're really using there, they're using the word interesting to replace a different word.
I believe it's fun, isn't it?
Well, I would say it's authentic. I would think it's real. The thing is, when we see a character who is so good, they become immediately imaginary. I'm even saying this is figures in politics, in sports, real people. When we see someone who seems totally pure, it doesn't seem like something we can really aspire to. Maybe as a kid we could have, but as an adult, it almost seems like they're a different sort of class of individual. And yet when we see a bad person, there's a reality there that we can intrinsically relate to. That we just know, you know, I shouldn't say everybody feels this way. I feel this way. I fear sometimes what my real motives are. Like, you know, I try to convince myself the way I live my life is for sort of moral reasons. But I really wonder because it is my belief that people do not control how they think and feel. We're always trying to convince ourselves that we do. For the most part, our thinking is really shaped by things beyond our control, and those thoughts end up driving our feelings. So it seems like our own agency, but actually we're kind of being pushed that way by things we don't understand.
You know, I think that's a really interesting thought about society. I was reading about Phil Mickelson recently, the pro golfer, you know, mm-hmm. who's had this lily white reputation, and now all of a sudden you're starting to see writers write about the other side. Because apparently he's universally detested on the tour. In fact, they have a rather offensive acronym for him, which ends with, I'm good, just ask me.
Yeah. the example you just brought up is a great illustration of how arbitrary these things are. For the longest time, nobody was going to vilify Phil Mickelson for one very clear reason. He seemed to be almost subservient in terms of ability to Tiger Woods. You wanted Phil Mickelson to be a good guy because we needed someone to sort of be the adversary for this untouchable figure. And as Tiger's career has begun to, you know, rapidly erode, I think that people then look at Phil Mickelson and say, like, well, okay, he's sort of, if not the best player right now, the dominant personality who seems to be in all of these. Every time we're watching a tournament on television, Phil Mickelson's in the heart of it. So then his perception changes, that we're no longer automatically sympathetic toward him. We're neutral to him. And once we're neutral, we start looking for the reality. And the reality is, seems like a jerk.
Well, one of the things I love about these essays is you are able to bring together all these different... One of the very first essays, you mentioned Snidely Whiplash, which you said, if you had to think about the most villainous act in the world, it would be tying a person to a set of railroad tracks, which is funny.
Yeah, well, it's like that's like a caricature of villainy almost. I mean, that's what we there is. You know, you're not going to find a book or a film or a play or a television show or a news story where a person tying someone to a railroad track is the hero. That's like shorthand for this person is terrible.
But your essays bring together Snidely Whiplash, Niccolo Machiavelli, Joe Paterno and Newt Gingrich in the course of a single essay, which is really, really interesting. In fact, you say Niccolo Machiavelli probably got a bad rap.
Oh, almost certainly. There's no question about it. I mean, there's a guy who, you know, he writes this book, The Prince, and it's a book of satire. It's a book making fun of the idea of how power is achieved. You know, when he was alive, you know, in Italy, the belief was that if you wanted to be a successful ruler, you had to be the most virtuous, because if people followed you, they would follow you because of your virtue. So, of course, that became this self-perpetuating falsehood, that anybody in power therefore believed they were virtuous by fact of the matter that people were following them. and he was pretty much kind of attacking this central lie. And he did it so successfully. He did this satire so well that people assumed this is actually what he was proposing. And it was so straightforwardly aggressive and kind of overtly diabolical, they basically just tried to destroy his life. So really, what was Machiavelli's fatal flaw? It wasn't what he actually believed. It was his consciousness. It was his ability to have those thoughts. One of the themes I use in this book, and it's not perfect. I'm not saying this is true in all cases. But if somebody asked me, as I did all this research, what are the unifying elements of villains? The closest I came is that the villain is the person who knows the most and cares the least. They have the clearest understanding of how to manipulate the culture, and they have the most kind of natural ability to dictate other people's behavior and sort of outsmart people without having any investment in what that actually means. They don't really care what happens to the world. They just sort of like playing with the world.
And as an example, you use the late, great Penn State football coach, Joe Paterno.
A little bit, yeah, because is he the most villainous person in that scenario? Probably not. But he did know the most. He knew what was going on. He knew the people who were involved, and he knew what was at stake. And while maybe he didn't care the least, he definitely prioritized what he cared about poorly. And that basically he put the status of the football program above the lives of these kids whose lives have been ruined. And it was still coming back from that for him.
Yeah.
When people saw that, and they couldn't get around the fact that he knew something but didn't care enough to change it.
Yeah, and in this case, it was the actual fact that Jerry Sandusky, one of his assistant coaches, was pretty much regularly assaulting young kids.
Yeah.
Sometimes even in the Penn State locker room.
And on Penn State road trips. He took the little kid to the Alamo Bowl in Texas. Not to get too specific about this case, I mean, the thing we'll never know is Paterno's level of awareness. I mean, we knew at one point this was reported to him, that something was going on. He had this cancer in the organization. I guess we'll never know to what degree he understood what was happening. But, I mean, I think the conventional wisdom on this is that, boy, it's too bad that he didn't die 6 months earlier, that Paterno didn't have to go through sort of the humiliation and the sadness of what happened.
My guest today is Chuck Klosterman. He's a writer and essayist. He writes the Ethicist column for the New York Times Magazine, and he's the author of a number of collections of essays. His latest is titled, I Wear the Black Hat. It's all about villainy. Villains who aren't villains, people who want to be villains, what makes one person a villain and another a hero. And it was really interesting. There's a wonderful essay about vigilantes. He said, imagine if Batman were real.
I think that was the first essay I wrote for the book, actually, because I was really fascinated by the concept of the vigilante in society when it's not attached to any specific person. If you were to just go up to any intellectual person and say, hey, what do you think of someone who sees injustice in the world and decides to take justice in their own hands? Almost any intelligent person will say, you can't do that. That you just can't, there's a framework set up for this. We can't try people by ourselves. We have to sort of let the system work. But when the Bernard Goetz situation happened in New York in the early 1980s, and this guy on a subway shot three people who were coming up to him he said sharpened screwdrivers, and he had a gun, and he shot these people, and he fled. The initial reaction, when that's all they knew, that this event had happened, was to almost universally side with the vigilante, like someone is finally trying to take back the city. Well, then Bernard Goetz eventually gives himself up to the police. We find all these other details about his life, many of which are problematic. And over time, his support completely disappeared. Now, at this point, almost no one is on his side. So what it seems to suggest is that people do not agree with vigilanteism as a concept. And they hate the vigilante when they understand him. But when all they know is that someone has acted as a vigilante, we know nothing else about his motives, there's a desire to be like, well, let's believe it was right. Let's believe he was correct. So I was thinking about this as it applied to, say, a fictional character like Batman. And as crazy as it seems, I just put a lot of effort into trying to imagine what would happen in, say, Brooklyn, you know, if a character like Batman emerged, or someone at night was dressed up in a costume, attacking people seemingly at random, but every time it was discovered who he was attacking, it turned out that person was a criminal. How would the media react? How would a smart person react? Would we feel as though it was wrong to be excited about this person, you know? So, I mean, a lot of this book is, I'm not really answering questions as much. It's just sort of presenting questions that I don't think are being asked.
Right. And in that particular essay, you're contrasting Batman, how we would think if Batman were real, Bernard Goetz, and you add in Charles Bronson's Death Wish, which we forget how incredibly, I mean, they made Death Wish 5. I mean, that's how.
Well, you know, and you go back and you watch Death Wish now. What's interesting about it is the sort of accidental depiction of the city of New York, in the sense that when they made that movie, you know, well, that's the whole story of Death Wish is interesting. A guy writes a novel that's against violence, okay? Someone interprets that novel into a screenplay that actually sort of makes the vigilante into the hero. So, you know, it's, even the original story was different than the one we got. When you watch that movie now, you see a place that seems unlivable. And I don't know if that was the intent of the director at the time. You know, there's the whole period of the 70s where you have films like that and the film The Warriors and all these things, and they sort of show a city that just doesn't exist anymore. It almost seems like a fairy tale, like could it have ever existed?
And so have you been surprised at how that reaction has changed, or what was at the time? Because, I mean, those movies were popular.
Well, yeah, well, you know, I grew up in North Dakota. I moved to New York in 2002. So when I saw The Warriors, my assumption was, I don't know if I assumed that's exactly how New York was. I really didn't believe there were, you know, street gangs who dressed up like baseball players. That seemed even unrealistic to me at that age. You know, they had kind of wore Kiss makeup and like it.
Right.
It seemed very weird. But I almost thought of it as a place that had no connection to the rest of America. And now I live in New York, and for different reasons, I still think that's true. It doesn't feel like I live in America anymore. It feels like I live in a country, a different country where they speak English. It seems so different than the experiences I had in North Dakota, and I lived in Ohio for a while. So I can't really gauge if I'm surprised by that change. I'm surprised when I go to parts of the city that seem totally gentrified and have nothing but, like, kind of sort of rich 22-year-old hipsters living there, and people say, like, 15 years ago, you'd have never walked through here. Yeah, that doesn't seem possible to me that it changed that fast, but I guess it did.
Well, there's another essay about villains who are not villains, or sometimes people we don't think of villains who really in their real behavior are villainous. And you use the examples of hijackers, con artists, drug dealers, and people who use race as a way of taunting one another. And the examples are very interesting because hijackers, that seems like a piece of villainy, but you mentioned D.B. Cooper. And the whole story,
you know,
of D.B. Cooper.
I got into D.B. Cooper when I was really young. There used to be a television show hosted by Leonard Nimoy called In Search Of. And I think I remember at the age of 7 or 8 seeing this episode about D.B. Cooper. This guy, a well-dressed guy, gets on an airplane in the Pacific Northwest with a bomb and essentially hijacks the plane for money, parachutes out of the plane, is never found again. You know, and he's just like a folk legend now in the Pacific Northwest. Like, they're whole days to celebrate, you know, his existence. Well, now, of course, the idea of celebrating the idea of someone who brings a bomb onto a plane is just totally off the table. It would be impossible to imagine a D.B. Cooper character in the modern sense. And, you know, I was just sort of talking about, you know, what was different about his scenario, besides just being, you know, back, you know, in distant in time, and the fact that in the 60s and 70s, America kind of had a hijacking culture. You know, got hijacked and flown to Cuba, not regularly, but often enough that people weren't shocked by it. But talk about how that has, you know, how of course anybody thinks of a plane hijacker as a villain. And yet when we actually have this one American example, we love the guy. And, you know, and con artists. You know, everyone knows a con artist is a villainous person. He's someone taking advantage of people. He's using their confidence against them. And yet, in most depictions of con artists in film or in books or in television, the con artist is almost always likable. And if there's a villain, it's another con artist who kind of betrays him. Fundamentally, you know, it's like So I just kept using, I kept bringing up ideas of like, well, of course you see this person negatively, but here's a specific example of that. How do you feel now?
You also talk about Muhammad Ali and his treatment of Joe Frazier, where, you know, we think of Muhammad Ali as this icon of sport and also of standing by your principles. And yet what he did to Joe Frazier, I think even the most ardent Ali admirer would say was not a good thing.
Well, you know, it's just, it's a problematic thing. I mean, if somebody says, what athlete in the 20th century was most important to the civil rights movement? I would say Ali immediately. Some might say Jackie Robinson,
yep.
You know, but I would say Muhammad Ali for the amount of influence he had. And yet, during those kind of three epic fights he had with Frazier, he basically did a very strange thing. He simultaneously accused Frazier of not being black enough and that somehow he represented white America, and also used kind of straight-up racist language, comparing him to a monkey and saying he couldn't talk and all of these things. And this is like, you know, we've kind of collectively decided to forget this happened because we know Ali is important. We want him to be heroic. So we've just sort of decided that, well, we'll recognize it's happened, but we will not make it part of his legacy. It's a little bit how, like, you know, say a big Beatles fan does not want to even sort of have a conversation about the fact that there are always accusations of John Lennon hitting women. But they don't even want that to be part of the conversation. It doesn't seem like it fits with everything else. So we just kind of remove it. Everyone concedes that, you know, Muhammad Ali was this incredible political figure, but he was actually a much more radical political figure than people seem to remember. I mean, at one point, he actually had a meeting with members of the Ku Klux Klan because they both agreed on one strange issue. They were both against interracial marriage. So, like, he was that on the fringe. But now, because of the overall impact of his life was so positive, we've kind of decided to only think of him in one context.
My guest today is Chuck Klosterman, a writer and essayist. His latest book looks at the nature of villainy, I Wear the Black Hat, which is now out in soft cover, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. I have to ask about one of the new essays that appears in there, which writes about Seinfeld. And you actually refer, if Snidely Whiplash tying women to train tracks is the most villainous act, Seinfeld is the most villainous sitcom ever made. And actually, when you think about it, by your definition of villainy, it makes sense. The villain knows the most but cares the least. And, of course, Seinfeld, the whole show was about nothing and about how you don't care about anything but your own self-absorbed life.
You know, it's totally true. I mean, and the popularity, the mass popularity of Seinfeld was kind of what makes this interesting. I mean, obviously it was a great show, great characters, great writing, and yet sort of the bottom line message of Seinfeld was that you're an idiot to care about other people. That's just this deep waste of time. And I kind of talk about this in the context of satire, because when people satirize things, say they want to satirize, you know, the far right conservatives or the, you know, far left liberal, you know, they tend to attack whatever person is on top of the pyramid, the president. Like the most outspoken member of that ideology. The fact of the matter is, the people at the top of these hierarchies are kind of designed to absorb criticism. Like, you and I could say anything we want about the president right now. Nothing's going to happen to us. Nothing's going to happen to him. It's just that it's like he's insulated from that discourse. So, if you really want to attack the ideas that you feel, you know, the president represents, you can't attack the top. You actually have to attack the bottom. You have to attack the people who are just sort of propping up this ideology. And as the leader, you know, is kind of interchangeable, they will always sort of be the backbone. But this is very difficult. This sort of requires us to criticize normal working class people who just don't know any better. And that's exactly what Seinfeld did. Seinfeld actually went after the kind of person who was just trying to live their life under the kind of the social mores with which they were raised, and are sort of, and the program kind of argues that that kind of thinking is absurd. Yeah.
But I think the interesting thing about that sitcom was it was self-aware of that, because you think of their finale. What do? They end up in jail.
But, you know, so much of that was based around the ideas of Larry David. And right. Larry David was not involved with the last season until the finale. And I will say that during the last season of Seinfeld, the show may have almost become too self-aware about that. It almost seemed like a caricature of this, and it kind of lost some of its effectiveness. The really effective episodes are actually right in the middle. What I did when I was writing this essay is I just set my DVR to tape every episode of Seinfeld that came on, and it's so heavily syndicated, you just rack up, you know, dozens and dozens of episodes. And I was really concentrating on not the subtext of the episodes, but the literal text, what the characters were literally saying. And if someone goes back and does that, they'll be kind of shocked by the things that these people say to each other. It just feels funny because of the way the lines are delivered.
Right. Well, we should mention another one of your hats in our last couple minutes. You've been writing the ethicist column for the New York Times Magazine for a while now, and I have to admit, I was just reading, I think, the last Sunday's column, and it was about a woman who lives in an apartment complex. There are six washing machines down on the bottom, and she takes all six of them at one time. Somebody else is coming in, and she's doing this, and says, "Hey, do you mind if I grab one?" And she goes, "No." And I'm struck. This column has run for years, and there's been several columnists that have written it. Are you surprised that the lengths people will go to justify ethically dubious behavior? In this case, she was wanting your vindication that it was okay to use all six washers at the same time and take up every washer in the complex.
Yeah, you know, and what's interesting is I said that it was selfish, and many people disagree with me. Because what I found is that when you use it, I mean, the term ethics is so loaded in a weird way, in that a lot of people were arguing that ethically she had every right to do that based on the idea of first come, first serve. That is the ethic that they subscribe to. Now, to me, that is technically a kind of ethic. It seems like a bad ethic. It seems like a bad way to settle problems. But the more I write this column, the more I realize that what people really want is a kind of social vengeance. that they really want people, they want people to be punished. And they often criticize my analysis for not being hard enough on the writer. I find that real interesting, you know. Especially when it's a stranger, people want to see people pay.
Well, it sounds like it's a lot of fun, and you get a lot of interesting ethical dilemmas. Some are not so black and white as using all the washing machines.
Yes.
Well, we wish you great success with that, and a wonderful collection of essays on the nature of villainy. I wear the black hat. Chuck Klosterman, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Writer and essayist Chuck Klosterman speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He writes the Ethicist column for the New York Times Magazine, and his most recent book is out in softcover, I Wear the Black Hat. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.